from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. According to the authors of a new book, The Coddling of the American Mind, so-called trigger warnings, microaggressions, and intellectual safe spaces are destroying higher education and the emotional health of students on college campuses.
Many students seem to be interpreting things not through the lens of is this right or wrong, or even is this offensive or acceptable, but is this dangerous or safe?
Social psychologist Jonathan Haidt joins us to discuss recent shifts in how students perceive freedom of expression and what he sees as the cult of safety on American campuses and what we should do about it. That's all coming up after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. In 2015, The Atlantic published an article by social psychologists Jonathan Haidt and Greg Lukianoff describing how the rise of trigger warnings and other efforts to protect students from potentially offensive material was not only bad for education, but society as a whole. The article, titled The Coddling of the American Mind, sparked a national conversation about fragility and a call out from President Obama on the importance of diverse viewpoints. Now, Haidt and Lukianoff have expanded the article into a book. And Jonathan Haidt joins us to discuss what he sees as the danger of emotional reasoning accepted as evidence and how to regain a balance between safe spaces and free speech. And welcome back to Forum, John Haidt. Good to have you back with us.
Thank you, Michael. A pleasure to be back.
Well, let's begin by saying that we're not talking about in your book or in the article in Atlantic or the national conversation that has resulted about what might have been your parents' PC. We're not talking so – I mean, hate speech is part of it. It's a big part of it, of the 80s and 90s. But we're talking about more the awareness of emotional well-being and an awareness of a kind of cultural fragility that carries with it vindictive protectiveness.
Mm-hmm. That's right. So students are political creatures. That comes in waves. Students were very political in the 60s. They were shout-downs of speakers. So campus protests are nothing new. What's new, what Greg Lukianoff noticed beginning in 2014, was this new element that if this person comes to speak or if this book is assigned or if this idea spreads on campus, this will damage people. This will be harmful. It's this new fragility that made Greg notice that something was new around 2014. I then began to notice it. I was a professor. I'm a professor at New York University. I began to notice it in some students there. And so we wrote this article in 2015 about how the students were in some ways enacting the very cognitive distortions that Greg had learned to not do when he learned cognitive behavioral therapy, things like catastrophizing, black and white thinking, things that are just really the opposite of the way you want to learn to reason and do critical thinking in college.
And also not necessarily facing fears. I mean, they can be real fears, and some of them probably can be certainly legitimate fears. But the reality is that good psychology says, you know, if you're afraid of getting in an elevator, you should get in an elevator.
Exactly. So the idea of students as growing, learning, pushing themselves, stepping out of your comfort zone, that used to be a good thing, to step out of your comfort zone. But around 2014, we started to see the emergence of an idea that if students are pushed out of their comfort zone, they will be damaged. Therefore, we need to extend and fortify the comfort zone. And if you think of college, if you think of college classrooms as intellectual safe spaces where you won't be pushed out of your comfort zone, everybody loses.
And there's also some pretty noteworthy and ludicrous examples of pushing these to, well, very subjective levels. I mean, that's often what seems to accrue here. And let's talk about some of the examples, I mean, because you sort of catalog them in many respects in your book.
Well, so we have a lot of examples in the book that are well known to readers who follow these events on campus. It often begins with an email, a well-meaning email. And what's notable is that people are judged not for their intent, not for what they're trying to do. It tends to be a single word. A single concept, a single word that someone takes to be offensive. So at Claremont McKenna, the word was mold. Someone said, the dean there said, we're really trying to help students who don't fit into our CMC mold. And a student took that in the worst possible way, that she was saying that you don't fit into our mold. You don't belong here. So it's often a single word in an email. But it's I want to go beyond the well-known stories that blew up and made it into the newspaper and talk about how the texture of everyday life on many campuses has changed. This is not most campuses in America. There are 4,500 schools in America, and most of them, this is not happening. But at most of, and possibly all of the elite schools, especially in the Northeast and the West Coast, it seems to be happening. So just one little example from my friend Deborah Mashick, who runs Heterodox Academy, an organization I co-founded. She was talking with a student at Harvey Mudd College, where she was teaching, and the student began to say, "Oh, yeah, that's a good idea, because that would allow us to kill two birds with..." And he put his hand over his mouth, and he stopped himself from speaking. And Deborah said, "Wait, what, were you going to say kill two birds with one stone?" He said, "Yes, but that's violent. I shouldn't say that." And so there's... Because students now, since 2014 or so, because they live in a call-out culture where anyone has the authority to call them out for any word or idea that could in some way be construed to be aggressive or sexist or anything else, students are, it's as though they're living their intellectual lives in a minefield and they develop fearful habits. Again, this is bad for everyone.
I thought this was much more pervasive on the Atlantic Coast and the Northeast and the Ivy League schools back east. But in your book, for example, you write about these 10 UC schools with the featured deans and chairs, and they decided that America's a land of opportunity should be a verboten thing to say. Mm-hmm. I believe in the most qualified person getting the job should be a verboten thing to say. In other words, so much of this seems, in some cases, frankly, extreme, but also just so subjective. What hits people's radar, which may not hit other people's by any stretch, the majority even for that matter.
That's right. So imagine trying to assemble a diverse community in a diverse democracy, and we should have some speech norms. And we can certainly set norms. You know, we set norms about there are certain words that we just don't use in public. So that's all fine. But imagine that we then extend that to say one group or one subset of society gets the right to say, we're the interpreters. If we find any way to interpret a phrase as being hostile to any of the groups we care about, you can't say it. And so the idea that America is a land of opportunity, well, what could be wrong with saying that? This comes from an article that introduced the concept of microaggressions in 2007 by a professor at Teachers College Columbia. He had a long list of examples of microaggressions. And so it is possible in some context someone might say America's land of opportunity, and they might mean that as if to say, therefore, immigrants who aren't successful are lazy. I mean, maybe that could happen. But to say, therefore, no one can say this because it will always be taken as a microaggression. Again, it's creating speech norms that make it very difficult to have conversations.
It's also difficult sometimes politically. I mean, we operate under a principle here where we like to have all kinds of different views, even views that go against the majority of our listeners' views, perhaps. And when I started working behind this microphone in public radio now over 25 years ago, there was a lot of hue and cry about putting people on from the Hoover Institution mm-hmm. because they were fascists in the minds of some right. of our listeners. This is a public radio station supposed to serve the public. It's always seemed to me axiomatic that when you have ideas that are counter to yours, it makes you think critically mm-hmm. to a greater degree, not obnoxious, not racist or necessarily violent in gendering, but where you draw the line on all this. For example, as a teacher of literature, I was a little shocked to read that there were students complaining about studying The Great Gatsby because mm-hmm. The Great Gatsby has violence in it, and that makes people feel uncomfortable and not safe. So how many works of great literature are you supposed to eliminate on that basis?
That's right. So what I've found, I started this organization with some other social psychologists called Heterodox Academy because we believe as professors that the only way to find the truth is to bring people together who will challenge each other's confirmation biases. We all are biased to confirm what we already believe, and the magic of a university is exactly what you said. You bring people together who will raise objections that you couldn't think of yourself. And so what I found is that the areas that really understand this logic, in addition to the academy and the sciences, is journalism and law. Both of those communities really understand that you have to have this adversarial relationship, hearing both sides, putting them together, is the way that you find truth, even if it is uncomfortable at times.
But you write about some concern about teaching rape in the law at Harvard Law School because it has the word rape in it.
Violation. The word was violation.
Violation, right.
Right.
Yeah. And therefore that made someone uncomfortable, and so mm-hmm. it should be excised, censored?
That's right. So to go back to your example of bringing people onto the radio, even people who go against your listeners' average views, if someone called in and said, you know, I'm offended by what you put on. Would you therefore take it off the air just because they said they were offended?
I'd have to know what it was specifically. We would have to consider it. We're a team. We look at things in that view. But if it's offensive to just one individual, probably not, because there are things that I don't say that give people offense
or take umbrage at. Okay. So you wouldn't take it off just because someone said, that's offensive, I disagree strongly. But what if someone said instead, this has harmed me. This has harmed my child. What you're doing is hurting vulnerable people. Would that make you more likely
to consider? It's a very difficult thing to navigate because these are personal realities. These are subjective realities. We like to think that we hear both sides. We consider both sides. We weigh as much as we can on the objective as much as one's possible in broadcast journalism and therefore give everyone a voice as much as we can. But the reality is you're up against a lot of shibboleths here. You're up against a lot of sacred type of feelings.
That's right. That's right. And that's what this is really about. Some people say, on the right, they're always saying, oh, those campus snowflakes. Snowflakes is a terrible word. And I don't think it's true that students are particularly fragile. There are many more students who are suffering from depression and anxiety. We can come back to that issue. But I think a lot of this move to regulate speech is not really about protecting vulnerable people. I think it's really best understood as an extension of the culture war. So left and right have been hating each other more and more since the 90s. The numbers go up every time they measure it, every 4 years. And a lot of what we're seeing on campus around speech is actually, I believe, prosecuting a political or moral battle by other means. People are trying to get an advantage in an argument by changing the terms of the argument.
Well, when somebody like Yiannopoulos comes to Berkeley and students decide, you know, he has a history of ridiculing transgender people and doing things that are certainly egregious by most people's standards, they feel they want to go against them and they want to raise social protest and show that there's not a fairness in terms of what he has to say and maybe carry it to an extreme. But where do you draw the line? For example, somebody like Alex Jones, you know, should he, because he represents an extreme point of view, be allowed? He wants to come on and say that Sandy Hook was all actors and not real propagate
that? Okay. So here I think it's really helpful in all of these discussions to say, what institution are we talking about? So if we're talking about, does Alex Jones have a right to say what crazy stuff he wants in the public square? I think the answer is yes. The First Amendment gives him that right to say it. He can't be punished for saying it unless he violates libel law. But a university is not the public square. We're trying to do something very special, of enormous value to society, something that can't be done in the public square. This is why we talk about an ivory tower. This is why Plato and Socrates retired to a grove of olive trees outside of Athens. We're trying to create norms and community in which ideas can be discussed and debated. So I see no value to inviting Alex Jones to speak because universities lean pretty far left these days, the elite ones especially. I think there's a lot of value to inviting conservative intellectuals. That would be great. I don't think Milo Yiannopoulos counts as a conservative intellectual.
I don't even think he counts as an intellectual.
He's actually pretty well read. I mean, he actually does critique ideas in a performance art sort of way that is aggressive and that is offensive to many people. But I'm just to your point, we should not be thinking about this in terms of the First Amendment. Does someone have a right to speak? We should be thinking about, what are we trying to do on campus?
We're talking, if you've just joined us, with Jonathan Haidt. He's Thomas Cooley Professor of Ethical Leadership at the NYU Stern School of Business and co-author with Greg Lukianoff of The Coddling of the American Mind, How Good Intentions and Bad Ideas Are Setting Up a Generation for Failure. Your book has gotten some pretty good reviews, but I want to read something by Noah Berlatsky, who really took on the book in Pacific Standard in a recent piece. And he writes that your book, quote, presents student anger as unwarranted, the result of spoiled, sensitive kids not being able to withstand adversity. But often protest is based in real injustice and real hardship. If people don't cry and when they're kicked, people will keep kicking them.
Mm-hmm. So we've had a lot of reviews. This is the only one we've had, which is negative. And it's from a guy I think people should look at his style in his writing and on Twitter. To get a bad review from him is not, in my mind, a badge of shame. He focuses a lot on how he says we're telling students they should just sit down and shut up and not object. And that's not true at all. If students want to object to injustice, of course they should. And there is enormous injustice that they should protest. And so if we want to talk about systemic racism and the criminal justice system, yes, there is a, those are problems that are not going to be fixed by students writing nice letters saying, oh, you know, the criminal justice system should be different. There are certainly things and systems that will only change if you force them to. So public protest is essential. The question is, how should we handle improving relations on campus? That is our concern. And this is what is new in the last few years, is these college campuses where the protests take place, they tend to be the most progressive schools. They're extremely anti-racist, anti-sexist, very welcoming places. What's the best way to improve things at Yale? Is it through aggressive protest, or is it through working with the system? Now, at places like Yale, where I went to Yale as an undergrad, I've been in touch with the institution for a long time. The kinds of
but
arguments,
you're still of a different generation, and this is another point in the Pacific Standard article that you don't necessarily relate to the millennials because you're not a millennial.
Well, this is not.
There's a bias of your demographic.
No, but actually, that's right. Well, that certainly that's fair enough. I certainly can't argue dispute that point. And he is certainly right that that we should be reading and listening to the members of that generation. And we did. We did try to read a lot of the writings of that generation. A very important point to make is that this is not about millennials. So the millennials were born between 1982 and 1994. The last millennials graduate around whatever 2016 or so. So the all these issues only come to the fore. This new way of thinking about speech and vulnerability only emerges in 2014. It's basically when iGen or Gen Z shows up on campus. So this book is not at all about the millennials. The millennials are totally fine about speech. They don't believe in shutting people down because they say something that they disagree with. The puzzle which we set out for ourselves is, what's going on with the kids who began coming in around 2013, 2014? How did their childhoods change?
So you seem to be in agreement that maybe you wouldn't invite Alex Jones onto a campus, or that wouldn't be exactly a positive idea in the sense of good discourse or critical thinking or the kinds of things that you're trying to enhance. What about Charles Murray? I mean, Charles Murray appears at Middlebury, and there's a violent response. Somebody gets their hair pulled, and because he's looking at and doing investigation of IQs based on genetics, essentially.
No, he's not. He wrote a controversial book in the 90s, and that earned him a lot of hostility. And then in the wake of the Trump election, so Trump is elected by surprise. People are very surprised at this. Why did the white working class vote for Trump? Why did they abandon the Democratic Party? And Charles Murray wrote a book in, I forget, it was 2012, I think it was called Coming Apart. He's been studying exactly this phenomena that is dividing the entire Democratic world, the entire world of liberal democracies.
Now, you're talking about his more recent work, but there was work before that which some people felt was like Shockley's work and was pretty much intimating a connection between genetics and IQ and African-Americans and genetics and IQ.
Right. So should he be banned from life for stepping on a college campus to talk about social class and politics? That's the question.
That is a question, yeah. And your answer is pretty resoundingly no.
That's correct. If you take a religious view and you have blasphemy laws and you have heretics and you approach the world of ideas through this religious lens, I think universities are going to kind of shut down. So if a speaker is invited onto campus to talk about social class and politics and you have a violent protest to make him stop talking, I don't think this is very, again, it's just not good for anyone. It certainly isn't good for the students who learn the lesson that they should respond to ideas with violence, that they should unite to stop people from talking, they should unite to stop people from listening.
But how much of that has to do with, I hate to use this, goes probably from our earlier milieu we grew up in, but we heard a lot about outside agitators, and certainly at UC Berkeley there were these anarchists who came in, and they weren't necessarily even part of the student body, and they were a lot of destruction was caused, a lot of costly destruction was caused.
No, that's right, and that's important to keep in mind here, is that there has been actually very little actual violence from students. I was just talking with a recent grad from Berkeley. I spoke at the Commonwealth Club last night, and there was an intern there who recently graduated from Berkeley, and she said the Berkeley students went to the Yiannopoulos protest protest to have. It was like some sort of protest with love or something. They were going to dance around and exude love to cancel out what they saw as Yiannopoulos' hate. So I think that's great. That's a fine way to protest. And it was outside agitators, Antifa locals, who came in and actually made things violent. Now, some Berkeley students did participate in the violence, as far as we can tell. We don't know how many students were involved. But it is important to note, we don't want to say, we don't want to make it sound like students have lost their minds and they're going crazy and they're violent. That's not true. Most students are mentally healthy, they're happy, they come to college to learn, and there's hardly any violence. What there is a call-out culture. That, I think, is the real problem that's making academic life difficult.
Guess what? We're being called out here. Let me read
called
a comment.
Out.
Yeah.
Okay.
Comment from Nancy, who says, an older white man interviews a white male professor about the book he wrote with another white man about safe spaces on college campuses. Millions of women in this country are victims of sexual violence. People of color are victims of racism every day. Sorry, this book is backlash BS. Racism, sexism, xenophobia, and misogyny are not alternative viewpoints.
Well, if we were guilty of racism, sexism, and misogyny, or no, she's not accusing us of that. She's saying that we're justified.
Maybe not necessarily giving it the attention it deserves because we're in this safer place, being white and privileged and male.
Yeah. So, no. So, again.
And who are we to criticize safe space?
Yeah.
I don't think I was criticizing, but let me put that back on you. Who are you to criticize safe space?
Okay. So if the caller's point is that we each see issues if affected by our identities and interests, that certainly is true. My last book, The Righteous Mind, was all about moral psychology and how our intuitions come first, our reasoning is second. So it's a perfectly fair critique to say this book is unlikely to give the whole story and there are surely other sides. So that would be great. I would love to hear those other sides. I hope somebody will write a book from another perspective. But the question I would put back to the caller is this book is not, this is not a moralistic book. We're not saying they're bad, people are bad. This is a book about conflicting moralities and people pursuing policies with moral justifications that we believe are backfiring. So the question I would put is this. The core contentions of the book are that there are a few psychological principles that are essential for healthy growth. One of them is the principle of anti-fragility, that people need experiences and that if you shelter people, if you prevent them from overcoming their fears, that they're worse off for it. So it's true that I'm a straight white male, but as far as I know, anti-fragility is just as true regardless of your race or gender. The arguments we're making about mental health have been made by people of all races and sexes, and I think they hold true for everybody.
Well, that is the core of the argument in the book, that there is protection for ideas and words that some people don't like, and that that is somehow perhaps not necessarily the best thing, not only for education, but for even mental health. Well, what do you think? I'm going to put the listener question to you, our listeners. And have efforts to protect students from potentially offensive material gone too far? Where's the balance between a safe space and an open exchange of ideas? Let's hear from you. Our toll-free number is available right now. It's 866-733-6786. Feel free to join us. Again, you can do that at 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, post questions or comments there at kqed.org/forum. Click on the segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, or go to our Facebook page. We do want to hear from you, so please feel free to join us. Social psychologist John Hyde is our guest, calling out for the coddling of the American mind. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending this hour with Jonathan Haidt. He is co-author of a book called The Coddling of the American Mind. And in that book, it's argued by Jonathan and his co-author, Greg Lukianoff, that a lot of this overprotectiveness and concerns go back really to baby boomers being overprotective of their children because of the child abductions and faces on milk cartons and really the kinds of things that created a great deal of concern about safety. We had Columbine. We had so many things that seemed to converge, at least in the analysis here. And some of you may want to address that as well. But we're talking about microaggressions and trigger warnings and all of that sort of thing. And just the idea of keeping students safe by perhaps keeping away from or avoiding, evading things that can bring pain. I was actually teaching a book The Bluest Eye, which many listeners probably know, by Toni Morrison. And a student came up to me and said, this is about father raping his daughter. I don't want to study it. I don't want to come to class. I said, please don't. I mean, you know, if it makes you uncomfortable in that way, it's perfectly understandable. But you're saying these kind of borders have been pushed too far, and they've been pushed beyond reason to a great degree, I think. And your listeners off asking for advice. A listener tweets, what advice does Professor Haidt have for parents who want to push back on these ideas should they pop up at elementary or high schools? What can be done?
Yeah, so this is in some ways a social coordination problem. That is, most Americans, whether they're on the left or the right and whatever their race, most Americans want their kids to have a good education. They don't want them to be overprotected. Schools are often overprotective because they fear they fear bad publicity. They fear litigation. So we are seeing efforts to overprotect kids in schools. It's motivated from good places. It's motivated from desires to fight bullying. But what we've ended up doing is, in the name of protecting kids, we've denied them the learning that they need to become self-sufficient, self-governing adults. So, for example, my daughter is she's 8 years old, my kids go to New York City public schools, and she says at recess there's a playground monitor, and if two girls, you know, if one girl says to another girl, I don't like the way you did your hair, and the other girl cries, the playground monitor comes over and says, what's going on? So kids need thousands of hours of play involving cooperation and conflict. They need thousands of hours of being independent, and in that way they learn to be self-governing, but we've been denying that to them. One of the biggest changes, the most important changes, I would say, is ask people, at what age were you allowed to just go outside and walk several blocks to a friend's house or to a store? And until the 1990s, the answer was around 8 or 9 years old. At 8 or 9, you could go outside. I've studied street kids all over the world. It starts around 8. At 8, kids can run from the police. They can steal food. They can basically get by unsupervised. But something happened in the late 80s and especially in the 90s in which we pushed the age up to around 13 or 14 is the answer that I mostly get. We don't give kids the practice resolving their own conflicts. This creates a state called moral dependency in which they look for the there's always an adult there to solve the problem. We're not helping them by trying to stamp out conflicts or resolve conflicts. We're not helping our kids.
Let's go to our callers, and let's begin with Savala. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. This is an interesting conversation, and it's so nuanced and complex, and I appreciate all the layers that you're surfacing, but I'm struck by what's missing. I think that your guest is not accounting for the very real allostatic load that students and all kinds of marginalized people are carrying right now. I'm an educator and a lawyer, and I work at UC Berkeley with graduate students and undergrad students. And, you know, for example, when you have a comment like America's the land of opportunity, that's demonstrably false. And there have to be a million sort of footnotes to that idea to fully flesh it out and make it realistic. And students who are marginalized in this time are at capacity. There's a kind of, they're at the boiling point. They can't take much more of the marginalization that is so present in the world. And even at a liberal university, the curriculum, the leadership, the professors, it's all incredibly heteronormative and white. So just it being a progressive campus doesn't mean that marginalized people are not literally in their bodies carrying a tremendous amount of stress. And that's part of the harm that we're talking about. I don't really see the study author acknowledging that. I see him more putting the onus on the students to somehow change, when in reality, I think our institutions and our cultural vocabulary has not kept up with how burdensome it is to be marginalized. And so it's the vocabulary and the institutions that should be carrying the burden of this problem. And I, you know, the fact that we've got white males who wrote the book. I mean, that matters. And your guest dismissed it a little bit, but I wonder if the conclusions would have been the same if there was a team that included women, transgender people, brown people, so on and so forth. So I see some serious limits on.
Let me actually have our guest address those limits that you've brought up and that marginalization that you expressed. And thank you for that, Savala.
Yeah. So I certainly accept the premise, which is that long-term stress, especially stress that activates the HPA axis that leads to high cortisol levels, does have health effects. So I certainly accept the premise. The question is, how do we best prepare students from various identity groups for life in today's university? And so, let's think about students at UC Berkeley. Are they faced, but is it an objective fact that they are faced by constant acts of exclusion, racism, hostility, and rejection such that it's just an objective fact that their cortisol levels are high and therefore the administration has to change to get those levels down? I would say it's more likely exactly the opposite, which is stress is not a response to the objective physical world. Stress is a response to the world as we perceive it. And this is the deepest idea in all of the wisdom literatures. My first book was called The Happiness Hypothesis. It was about ancient ideas, and here is the number one ancient idea from every civilization. Marcus Aurelius said, Epictetus, "What really frightens and dismays us is not external events themselves, but the way in which we think about them. It is not things that disturb us, but our interpretation of their significance." Buddha said, "Our life is the creation of our mind." Shakespeare said in Hamlet, "There's nothing either good or bad, but thinking makes it so." So what are the appraisals we should teach to Berkeley students? Let's take a Filipino student or a black student. What are the appraisals we should teach them when they come in? Should we say, you should consider yourself to be a marginalized student, not historically marginalized? That makes, obviously, these groups were historically marginalized. But here at Berkeley, you should think of yourself as marginalized. You should see matrices of oppression operating all around you. You should assume that when people ask you a question like, where are you from, they mean you're not or you don't belong here. Is this what we should be telling them?
Let me hear what Savala has to say to that. Savala?
Well, a couple of things. Of course, life is partly what happens to you and partly how you react to it. But you can't reduce the conversation to that, you know, kind of pithy solution. I mean, tell that to Emmett Till's mother. It's not as simple as what you make of your circumstances. As far as, you know, what you should tell a student as whether they need to think of themselves as marginalized, I don't think you need to tell them that. They know that. They know it before they get to campus. They know it when they watch TV, when they read magazines. So it's not about the message that you send them in terms of who they are. It's about how fluent and committed the institution is in terms of demarginalizing them.
But there, too, you're pointing to real violence and injustice that occurs out in the world and saying that students, when they arrive on the Berkeley campus, they should interpret their interactions with their fellow students, the administration, through that lens. And this is our argument, is that there are choices to make, choices that the students make, choices that the administration can make in what frames to encourage. Let me just tell you very briefly a very short story. I was on a panel at NYU Law School 2 years ago. It was to discuss all of these issues. And there was a student, she was a Latina, a law student, and at one point she talked about all the violence perpetrated on NYU students, and I asked her to specify, what do you mean violence? Is there violence? And she talked about the ways that they are systematically excluded, and I asked her to give me examples, and she said, well, it is undeniable that this institution was not built for people like me. And I had to agree with her. It was not. And I looked around at the panel, and I'm Jewish. It wasn't built for me. There was Anthony Appiah, who's Ghanaian and British and gay. It wasn't built for him. There was a Chinese-American law professor. It wasn't built for any of us. So that's an objective fact. NYU was not built for a multicultural population. We all have a choice in what to make of that. And most of us on the panel thought, wow, NYU is a great place. It's open to all of us now. But so it was a self-marginalizing choice that this student and her cohort made to interpret the origins of NYU as a permanent act of marginalization, rejection, and exclusion. Our argument is that that's a choice. It's a choice which is really, really bad for students from identity groups.
Now, let me thank Savala for the call. And here's Rachel, who says, I disagree that Ivy League institutions are anti-racist and anti-sexist. They are filled with privileged people who often have very little perspective of disadvantaged groups. At best, they operate as colorblind.
I don't know what to say to that. I mean, you know, yes, it's not representative of the U.S. population, but the primary way, the primary problem we have in the Ivy League schools is by class. This is the great American problem. This is how America and other Western democracies are coming apart. It's not so much by race and or gender. It's by class. At the top schools in the United States, there are more people from the top 1% than there are from the bottom 60%. So if you want to talk about privilege by class, absolutely, that is the crucial conversation to have. I don't know what to do with beyond. What is the objection? What is the question that's full of privileged people?
Well, yeah, because you had said something about the Ivy League, and I think she was responding to that. But let me get some more callers aboard here, and let me go next to Deborah. Deborah, join us.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, yeah. So I'm actually calling in to mostly agree with the author. I'm black. I'm a Nigerian immigrant and went to college in the U.S., came to the U.S. for college and stayed on. And I really do feel that college is a place where you should be exposed to contrary ideas, because that way you're able to develop your own opinion, understand why you believe what you believe. I feel like coming to the U.S. from a pretty conservative country and learning about different ideas that I probably did not agree with when I first came in has broadened my mind, and I consider myself to be very liberal. And I think it's easy for us to agree with keeping speakers off campuses that we disagree with when they're, you know, from the right and we're from the left. But we need to think of the history of this country where similar practices have been done against people who were speaking for civil rights or speaking for ideas that we now accept as normal. I think it's easy to agree with something that is maybe not right when you're in agreement with the idea, but it's a slippery slope and no one knows what's going to happen in 10 years and where the tide will turn. So I agree that we should allow people with opposite ideas to speak on campus as long as it's not directly causing, you know, physical harm to students on campus.
All right, Deborah. Well, thank you for that call.
And I'd like to just add on for a moment. Yeah. Thank you, Deborah. I talk with a lot of international students, and I urge everybody to talk with international students because they're a great mirror for us. They have a perspective. They had certain expectations about American universities. Many of them have experience in universities in other countries. And overwhelmingly, what I hear, from students from China and Singapore and relatively authoritarian countries, they come here and they say, my God, I thought that I was going to come to the land of free speech, but I have to be so careful what I say. It's you know, I feel I have to self-censor. So I think that students who come here, in the last couple of years especially, this is our argument, the dynamics on campus around speech have changed. It's not that the average students has changed. It's that the fearfulness of speaking up is much greater now than it was a few years ago, especially on elite campuses. And international students are really good, well, not canaries in the coal mine. What's the metaphor? They're good observers.
Here's a good observer, a listener named Brandon, who says the anxiety and the disgust of the younger generation is rooted in the deep pool of problems facing their future. Older generations were able to afford a home, health care, an education, etc. Those currently and recently in colleges are aware that their future looks more bleak. It's not a call-out culture. It's so much larger than that. And here's Ivan, who says a lot of that this call-out culture does not have to do with sensitivity. Most people are willing to have challenging conversations, but the rules of dialogue need to be actively reimagined and adapted, not inherited. Some interesting points on both scores. And here's Courtney, who writes, I just want to point out how long we as a society have had to coddle people of faith, particularly Christian people. Also, we have to coddle male authority and not question how our society is structured, including coddling the feelings of policemen, doctors, bosses, any males in position of authority who exhibit male fragility when we suggest that they may not be the final word. Excuse me. Of course, you could argue, why should college campuses be any different than real life? I mean, even if that male hegemony is real, as she describes it.
So just a couple of quick reactions. It is certainly relevant to think, how does the world look to each generation? And I have heard this this argument a lot. And certainly your expectations. I just spoke to somebody who was born in the 1930s, and he said when he was in college, you know, was born, you know, poor Jewish immigrants in Queens, they just had the sense that things were going to work out. They were going to get a job and they were going to be able to make it. So I do agree the economic picture has changed. But in terms of the way the world looks, you know, each generation, if you actually put yourself in the situation of each generation was facing either the Depression, annihilation by fascist powers, nuclear war, stagnation, recession. This tends not to actually have much effect on mental health. What affects people is much more local things, local threats, local relationships. So, and also I should point out that the mental health problem, the rising rates of depression and anxiety have been going up in the 2010s as the economy has been getting better and better.
You mentioned your last book, which is about connectivity, and I've been not so much shocked but alarmed at statistics, which you're probably aware of the number of students who describe themselves as increasingly not only anxious but filled with anxiety in many directions, including loneliness and isolation, as they've become supposedly, according to the world of Facebook, much more connected.
That's
and
right.
Much more linked and so forth.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, let me get some more callers on. And
okay.
Let's go next to Mike. Mike, thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Thank you. I was just curious, like, how do you know whether you're actually being insensitive or if you're just being silent? Like, what about actual intellectuals like Ben Shapiro or Jordan Peterson who are being silenced for so-called hate speech that is actually backed by facts and statistics? I mean, Ben Shapiro, Berkeley spent $600,000 on security for him just to speak on campus. Mm-hmm. $600,000. I mean, think about that. It turned into nearly violent riots. Why will KQED never have someone like him on your show?
I will have Ben Shapiro on, and that's an open invitation, okay?
Wow.
So
love
don't
it, love
don't
it.
Say anything without the authority of knowing what you're talking about. But let me go back to John Haidt.
I think each side sees the people on its side as having been silenced. And I think what we need to focus on here is not being critiqued, but there are cases in which people are either disinvited or ideas are, if you say something, there will be a social sanction upon you. Now, of course, maybe you're saying something racist or sexist, and maybe it's appropriate to feel ashamed at it. The crucial thing, the crucial line that I think we've crossed in the last 2 or 3 years is the line between impact and intent. So if someone comes and there's any sense in which they have a goal of humiliating or insulting, then, again, they have a legal right to do that in the public square, but there's no value to that on campus.
The advantage of having someone here in the studio is I can go up against them and I can have my listeners go up against them, which they do quite mm-hmm. freely and so forth. So the public square presents a whole different arena when we're talking about.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And so I think we need to keep our eye on intent. There's been a recent move to say intent doesn't matter. All that matters is how you made someone feel. And that, while it might sound lovely, it might sound sympathetic, but imagine what that world would look like where you are responsible for what anyone in the audience feels. It has made teaching very, very difficult.
And let's assume that the working world is filled with misogyny and xenophobia and racism and anti-Semitism, just as a working assumption, or that there's a lot of it that students might actually encounter. Does it make them better to encounter those things and arm them better to be open to ideas or to feel that they have to be protected from those ideas?
Well, I would think that the immune system gives us a good example here. We want people to dislike racist speech, but do we want them to have an immune reaction to it? So let me trot this out. I don't know how this is going to go over. But I read The Adventures of Mark Twain and then The Adventures of Tom Sawyer and then Huckleberry Finn with my 7-year-old daughter. And we had to talk about whether to say the N-word, because it's especially in Huck Finn, it's there quite a lot. Now, it's a really, it's an anti-slavery book. It's a very powerful book. My daughter cried at certain scenes about how Jim is treated. But I decided we are going to say it in private. We will say it, the N-word. And then after we were done, we went through all the racist terms for other groups, including Jews. My kids are half Korean, and we went through words for Asians. Because I want my daughter to know that these words are out there. These are bad words, but I don't want her to have an allergic reaction. In other words, if she sees them in a book, she shouldn't freak out.
I remember, when they were trying to ban Huckleberry Finn
banned. That's right. It's being pulled off. In the last 2 years, Huck Finn is being pulled off of reading lists all across the country. And I want to ask listeners, is that a good idea? Is it a good idea to protect people from encountering the word when what we're fostering is now an allergic reaction that makes the word more powerful? The N-word becomes more and more painful and powerful the more we ban its very existence
from their childhood experience.
Let me get a tweet and your response to this tweet from Brett, who says, Michael, I can't get behind this. Perhaps for your guest, it's an intellectual exercise. For me, it's not. Does the guest even believe that there are marginalized people?
Oh, yeah, of course there are. But the question is, do you want to encourage people to think that they are marginalized as their identity? I am a marginalized person wherever I go in any context. That's a really good way to damage people. I'm not disputing the existence of terrible racism and racial violence in American society and elsewhere in the world. Again, our focus in this book is improving educational institutions, which are really trying to address these problems. We're really trying hard to address issues of diversity and inclusion. And if we start off by saying, welcome to NYU or to Berkeley, you are a marginalized person, this is a matrix of oppression, This is not helpful to them. I think it's not true in those contexts. And I think it's a bad way to teach people to appraise things.
You're listening to Forum. We're talking with John Haidt, and he is the author of The Coddling of the American Mind, co-author. This is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And we'll go to another caller. Let's go next to Oakland and welcome Corrine. Corrine, you're on the air.
Hi. I want to come back to something you said earlier, Michael, about your experience as a university teacher and a student coming to you with sensitivities about things you were talking about. Mm-hmm. And what I sounded like a very compassionate response on your part. And I think we're conflating a little bit the global issues of whether kids should be challenged with ideas different than their own with what a person as a marginalized part of a community feels in the moment in a classroom. My kids who are in university, one has been a victim of a sex crime. They both identify as part of the LGBT community. They're both Jewish. And they very much appreciate when a lecture can be begun or even warned the week before. The topic we're going to bring up later is going to have a lot to do with graphic descriptions of the Holocaust, or we're going to be addressing issues around sexual assault and sexual violence. If these are topics that could be hard for you, please come talk to me. It makes them able to cope with something that, for them, if they're surprised by it, doesn't enable them to hear another point of view or another perspective because they're too much in their body's response to the horrors of what they're experiencing.
Comment from you, John.
So this is the issue of trigger warnings or content warnings.
Yeah.
I certainly agree that professors should be explicit in the syllabus. This is what the course will cover. If it's a course on human rights, we're going to cover the Holocaust or whatever, or, you know, and various atrocities. Of course, they should be explicit. But it's an empirical question. It's a psychological question, whether in the long run it's better for students, such as the listener's children, is it better for them to get a warning before each class, which is basically saying, we're gonna talk about something that might be really upsetting to you, so I just want to let you know.
There's an example in your book of Chinua Achebe's Things Fall Apart, which is a great Nigerian. We had a Nigerian caller, so it comes to mind. Being questioned because there's racial violence in it. But, you know, it's probably one of the best books to come out of the whole continent of Africa.
Right.
So should you ignore it? Do you warn people? You
know? Right. So it's an empirical question. And if the psychological research community had concluded that trigger warnings or content warnings in the long run help people like the listener's daughters or children, if it helps them in the long run to be less harmed by invocations of traumatic experiences, well, then I'd be for it. But there is, first of all, no evidence that trigger warnings have that effect. Secondly, clinical psychologists and psychiatrists that we consulted were unanimous in saying that that the way that you help people over these fears is precisely to expose them to small doses where nothing bad happens to them. The thing is they're exposed to it, the word, let's say, or an image, they're exposed to it. They might have a galvanic skin response might go up. There might be some stress hormones, and then those go down. And if that happens a few dozen times, they habituate to it. The images no longer have power over them. So the very idea of thinking of a world full of triggers, this is a choice. And the question is, do we want to do we want to have our children see a world full of triggers where they are effectively endowing many aspects of the outside world with triggering powers, or do we want to make them immune to these triggers?
Especially the popular culture. I mean, when you think of what's on TV or what's in the movies, I mean, there's so many triggers that you can't even see straight.
Exactly. So you know, one of the principal quotes in the book is prepare the child for the road, not the road for the child. And, you know, maybe before the internet, maybe it would have been possible to say, I'm going to block out reminders of bad things from my kids. But they're immersed in it. They're going to be for the rest of their lives. So we have to help our kids get to the point where the outside world is not full of triggers. And you don't do that with trigger warnings.
I want to read a comment from Ben, who says a call-out culture is the opposite of fragility, a culture in which people can be called out for their personal biases and how they affect their contributions to the discourse is a good thing. What you call intellectual minefields, I call thinking critically before you speak.
If it was true that people were pretty accurate in appraising what is hateful and there was some consensus on it, then you could maybe argue this is a very efficient means of social control and sharing norms. But as you talk to teenagers who are in a call-out culture, that's not what you hear. What you hear is horror stories about how they said something perfectly innocent. They said something that was trying to be helpful. It was taken out of context. One word was taken out. So mobs have all kinds of properties. Social media has suddenly made it much easier to create self-righteous mobs. So in theory, I understand the listener's point. But as I see it happening, social media-enhanced mobs are bad for everyone.
John, thank you for this hour. Good to have you with us back on Forum. Jonathan Haidt, again, is co-author of Coddling of the American Mind, subtitled How Good Intentions and Bad Ideas Are Setting Up a Generation for Failure. And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour is repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. And the Forum program is produced by Judy Campbell, Tina Lauerberg, and Christina Kim. Senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our engineer this week is Danny Bringer, as it is most weeks. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, and we get online support from Amanda Font. Interns are Kate Wolf and Josh Koh, managing editor Ethan Lindsay, and executive producer Holly Kernan. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and the Bernard Osher Foundation, supporting higher education and the arts.